You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Tuesday, February 21st. My pleasure to be with you. Thankfully, radio's just audible. You can't see that I'm in my checkered pajama pants this morning, broadcasting in my sleep gear because I can, quite frankly. Also, an old tattered sweatshirt that I would never wear in public. This is how it happens, see. It starts to happen. You know, I'm 50 now. Starts to happen at an earlier age. First, it's just, hey, I'm just taking the trash to the curb. There's no reason I can't go out there in my shorts and house shoes. The next thing you know, you're in the grocery store and you just happen to realize, you look down, oh, I'm wearing my house shoes. And then it all goes down from there. I always used to wonder how it happened that my dad would wear sneakers and black dress socks out to the mall. But I'm here. And you know what? I can. So that's the way it goes. We'll talk here in about 15 minutes with my friend Ina San Martin, who writes so excellently for Crux, Staking the Catholic Pulse website, founded and edited by John Allen Jr. Ines, who is just an outstanding writer, and I don't know that she sleeps, evidently. A lot to cover there with the Francis papacy, among other things. But we're going to be talking to her about a piece she wrote, I guess about a week and a half ago, and when she takes issue with this dichotomy, this simplistic dichotomy that there are Francis lovers and alt-right Francis hater wackos out there. And as she titles her piece, Media Frame of Francis Lovers versus Alt-Right Wackos Doesn't Cut It. You know, a couple of weeks ago observed that, you know, there is another option. Like, for example, when you talk about President Trump, that it's a false dichotomy, very simplistic dichotomy, to say that you either have to affirm everything the man does, or that you have to, and therefore defend it, or you have to criticize everything the man does and thus attack it. That there is actually another option, that is the possibility of sifting through the things that he does, critiquing what you can critique, affirming what you can affirm, and being delightfully agnostic when you don't know how whether something is good or bad. I think in some ways the same lens can apply or idea can apply to Pope Francis, or really any pope, in that we certainly believe in the papal office, and it's a sign of unity, and certainly the successor of Peter, the vicar of Christ on earth, should receive our great respect and obedience. Yet there are times, and we can take issue perhaps with something that the Pope does or a style in which he does it, and think, you know, I mean, he is a human being. And sometimes you hear this from non-Catholics, you know, the Pope puts his pants on just like I do. Yeah, that's true. Nobody ever said he didn't. Or the Pope sins. You know, he needs God's forgiveness as much as everybody. Yep, red herring. We agree with that. But sometimes when you get this idea that you're either for him or against him in all things, we kind of play into that narrative, and it's unfortunate. So Ines San Martin, who's an Argentinian journalist now living in Rome, covering the Vatican there for Crux, she spent a lot of time in Roman bars and coffee shops. It's a different story once you get feet on the ground and talk to people around and what they really think. So that'll be a good conversation we have with her in just a little bit. I also want to get back into thinking of first world atheism, as we talked about yesterday with my guest, Chris Andrade, who I find to be a fascinating person, this guy who left behind Wall Street trading to be a photojournalist, mainly among people often out of the public eye, addicts, those sort of rusted out middle America and so forth. But we'll talk about how atheism is kind of a first world issue a little bit more. We'll also talk about the power of the crucible, and we will remember Norma McCorvey, Roe of Roe v. Wade, who passed away just within the last couple of days. I've had a great visit with our adult daughter. She'll be getting on a big bird here in about, 8 hours or so to head back to Raleigh, North Carolina. Going to miss her terribly. I had to go to bed last night before completing the uproarious game of Balderdash with the rest of the family. You ever played this game? It's a great game. Oh, man. A lot of laughing. You know, it's sometimes it's called the dictionary game, where you have, you get the board edition or whatever, and they give you a card with, it's either some obscure initials or movie title or some strange vocabulary word that no one knows the answer to or the definition of. And then everybody writes out a fake definition to go in with the real one. And the person then reads them all off, and you have to decide, sort out the real definition or the real description of the movie, for example, because they're very obscure movie titles from the real. And I have to say, I've got some kids who were pretty creative and convincing in their false definitions. But I had to turn it in while they were having an uproarious time, just so I could be somewhat sane this morning. But a great visit with the daughter. Went yesterday to Natural Bridge State Park, which I don't know, there are a lot of states that have some sort of natural bridge rock type formation. We have one here in the state of Kentucky where we broadcast from. Absolutely beautiful. And yesterday, 70 degrees in February. I kind of commented on social media, as much as I loved the time and loved being in shorts and a t-shirt in mid-February, I'm not sure that's a good thing. Yeah, which I'm sure I'll then get texts from the climate change skeptics that, you know, it nothing new under the sun. And I know that's true, but boy, sometimes you really kind of get this sense that the climate is changing. I used to count myself, I think, among those ultra climate change skeptics. And then it occurred to me, I doubt that 95% or higher of the world's scientists are all collaborating together to conspire against John Q. Public. Maybe there's something to this, that we are having some impact as human beings on the environment. And anyway, it's sort of the environmental version of Pascal's wager. If we're not living a less consumer-heavy life that takes greater care on the environment, is a win-win regardless. So anyway, but I don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth. It was a beautiful day yesterday and a tough hike. I need to get in better shape for sure. Anyway, if you've got a comment or a question, 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com, or post a thought on Facebook or on Twitter. Yesterday, President's Day, and I didn't get to this, and this is going to frame the question of the day today. C-SPAN, I guess, does a presidential historians survey. Every time there's a new, somebody's presidency is completed. And according to this one, they surveyed 91 historians of the presidency and I guess polled them on the individual leadership characteristics of presidents, and then came up with a cumulative total and a cumulative rating. Those things like public persuasion, crisis leadership, economic management, moral authority, international relations, administrative skills, relations with Congress, vision, setting an agenda, pursued equal justice for all, performance within the context of the times. And they ranked the presidents 1 through 44. And Barack Obama came out number 12. You start off, of course, with Abraham Lincoln, then George Washington, then Franklin Roosevelt. One Facebook commenter
taking issue with Roosevelt's ranking being so high. I'll share that a little bit later. Teddy Roosevelt, his cousin, number four. Then Eisenhower, Truman, Jefferson, Kennedy, Reagan, Johnson, Wilson, and then Barack Obama coming in at number 12. Barack Obama finishing ahead of Bill Clinton, who came in at 15th. And let's see, George H.W. Bush coming in at 20th. So he makes the grade, makes the cut for the top 20. And then you go down from there. So my question is, do you think that ranking is too high for Barack Obama, or do you think that ranking is too low? And granted, it's tough, I think, to have a perspective on someone when you live in the time in which they were president. Sometimes some time's got to pass before you can more accurately judge them. But I'd be interested in what your thoughts are. A couple of comments we've gotten on Facebook so far on this question. And again, Barack Obama, any more than Donald Trump, not exactly a non-polarizing figure. Anna says, too soon to rank him. Kathy says, too high. Alex says, too high. Todd said this. No, I'll tell you what. I'm going to let you wait on Todd's comment because he takes issue with FDR's ranking being so high with a couple of issues and then uses that to cast light on how we judge Donald Trump. So anyway, when we get back from the break, we're going to talk to Ines San Martin from Rome. Talk to her about what she hears in the coffee shops and Roman bars there to kind of blow up this false dichotomy of Francis lovers versus alt-right Francis haters. We'll be back. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this 21st day of February. Pleased to be joined live via Skype from Rome by Ines San Martin, Vatican correspondent. She's an Argentinian journalist who covers the Vatican in Rome for Crux. Before joining Crux, she was a community manager, content director, and graphic designer for Conta Con Nosotros and worked as a reporter and editor for Valores Religiosos in Buenos Aires. Her English is much better than my Spanish, so I'm glad to have her on. Hello, Ines.
Hello, Mike. I have to say, though, your Spanish is pretty good. Most people, when trying to read what I did before joining Christ, I'm like, man, just stop. Please, stop. So, good for you.
Well, so you're working from home today. But I tell you, when I read your writings, particularly the article we're going to get into today, you make me feel, even though I've never been to Rome, like I'm just wandering around all these bars and coffee shops.
Good. I'm glad I made you feel that.
So this is, you do a lot of work from there, you said, and you spend a lot of time talking to people, and you kind of took issue with this false dichotomy, I guess you could say, that prevails, that, you know, you're either all in on everything Pope Francis does, you're a so-called Francis lover, or you're constantly hating on the Holy Father. You are probably in that. You're hanging out with Milo Yiannopoulos and Steve Bannon and the alt-right, you know, wackos. And really, when you talk to people, it's much more complex. Imagine that.
Yeah, it is. I love and appreciate my colleagues in the journalism business. It's not easy to be a journalist, this time of history. But it's, sometimes I think personally frustrating to see there are so many great stories, and yet we get trapped by the narrative. We get trapped into, oh, so you didn't like that thing Francis did on the weekend, then you're obviously the Pope Francis hatred. I'm like, what? No, I was just complaining at the fact that we never get a Sunday off. What does that have to do with anything? And in that sense, you see it a lot in the streets. And I mean, not just in Rome. I of course, brought about my experience in Rome, where, as you said, I spend most of my time and whenever I can working from bars, specifically because I want to make sure I never get too isolated, that I don't know what's going on, or I only know what's going on in the Vatican, which, although it's a great place to cover, it's just a little bit of the story. And
now, you said you also, Ines, want to avoid the temptation of doing laundry and cleaning, though.
Yes. and there is a laundry basket that can attest to the fact that it's not very tempting. It's just sitting there, and it's been sitting there for a week, and it will probably stay there until I'm out of clothes.
Just try to keep it real, all right?
Yes, yes. I'll always keep it real, you know. So, yeah, I mean, it amazes me just to, you know, to sit down at a bar and, you know, talk to people. Whenever I say I'm a journalist covering the Vatican, of course, everyone has something to say about it, from, oh, the Pope has one lung, which is just not accurate, but it's part of the narrative, to, you know, I love this guy, but why did he do X? You know, the classic example for those, I mean, the beauty of being in Rome is that most people I encounter are actually Catholic. No, I mean, they know about the church, they know what the discussions are because it's unavoidable based on the Italian newspapers. So it's very interesting to see, you know, people, and you speak with people who not only know what Amoris Laetitia's, Pope Francis' document on the family is, but they've actually read it. And they've, you know, even read the footnotes that have caused so much discussion in the blogosphere. And when you encounter them, when you talk to them, you realize that, yes, there is, in fact, people who, you know, dislike or extremely like what the Pope did in that document, but at the same time, don't appreciate whenever he talks about migrants. Or, you know, I don't like what he did with Amoris, but I do love the fact that he's so, you know, socially oriented. Which, by the way, it's worth noting, he's not the first pope to be oriented in social issues. That's another half-truth that we always write when we're journalists. But, yeah, that's why I wrote what I wrote.
Absolutely. Do you think that this dichotomy, or you might even say this extreme polarization, is that perhaps more pronounced in American journalism, do you think, and among Americans, because we're in a very partisan time? Or do you think that's just, that's just a global phenomenon?
I think it's a little bit of both, Mike. I mean, society as a whole is, I believe, polarized. I mean, we're talking about it, you know, in the Argentinian newspaper 6 to 9 months ago about the, well, you know, Argentine journalist called the crack, which is, you know, there is a great division between those who support one president and those who support the other. And there's clearly not a way for the two sides to come together. We're seeing it more and more in the United States. I think the sort of the biggest difference from the America perspective is that you guys are louder and bigger than everyone else. So when the, you know, the American media or the American people is polarized, it's, you know, it becomes more evident because you have a lot of ways to, you know, to show it, to prove it, and to scream it to the world that there is division in the United States, you know, politically, ecclesiastically, in families. I know so many I have so many American friends here in Rome who won't sit down with each other because one voted for one president candidate and the other one voted for another. Like, since when are we reduced to who we voted in any given year? And that's, I think it's a danger we're falling on or into right now, and that has to be addressed. And the media is a way of addressing it. We cannot continue feeding this aggressiveness, this division, this you're either with Francis or against him. And if you're with Francis, then you're against John Paul II and Benedict and everyone that came before him. It's just not true, I think.
I like that I was impressed with you being an Argentinian, weaving in Tom Brady and Roger Federer into your into your story.
Well, I'm a very big tennis fan. So the Federer one to me was very easy. And the Tom Brady, you know, part of my education when I first was hired by the Globe and then just Crux was the fact that, you know, I do write for an American audience and I do understand the need to, so you know, build that rapport and that sort of way of, you know, making your audience interested in the story you're trying to tell, which is not always necessarily interesting because we cannot relate. So let's find elements. And, you know, football was obviously one of those, although I will not claim to understand how the game is actually played because that's just no. Both football and baseball. And Mike, we have a common friend, which is John Allen, and he'll tell you he's tried. By God, he's tried, but I just cannot understand the rules of those games.
I'll
stick to soccer.
Well, just let it be for the record. I'm in the anti-Brady camp, but as are a lot of people. But there are a lot of people for him, too, of course, if you wrote
but
for the Globe.
But you would be able to appreciate that he's not a bad player, right?
Oh, yeah, he is. He's no doubt he's the best. That, you know, you don't hate people who are inconsequential. So let me ask you this about Pope Francis. So do you, and you know, in this where you have just this polarization, you either defend everything he does or you criticize everything he does. Don't you think that keeps us really from talking to each other and from, you know, looking at things on their merits? I mean, we as Catholics certainly believe that, you know, that a pope has the charism of infallibility on certain things, but on other things, you know, it's sort of fair game.
Right. I agree with you, Mike. I think we're being blinded by, do we love the guy or do we hate the guy? And we're incapable of, you know, I think seeing his teachings and seeing his words beyond the personality, which, you know, I personally, obviously, as an Argentinian myself, I can relate to all the Argentinian sides of Pope Francis, you know, his charisma and his openness and his willingness to be hugged and take drinks from people at St. Peter's Square, which is, if I might say, dangerous. And I would, if I could use R-rated words, stupid. But, you know, leaving, I think, the sort of charismatic or personality part of out of it, people today, I think, are not listening to Pope Francis as much as they should. They are just repeating whatever he says that fits the narrative they built of the man. For instance, you know, I'm surprised to see how every time Pope Francis talks about immigration, he's taking a jab at President Donald Trump, which he's not. He's talking at a Roman university about the need to integrate refugees who are coming to Europe, you know, by the thousands every day. Yet, of course, he can only think about the wall that is allegedly being built in the Mexican border. And that, I think, fits the alienation. Because we're not trying to understand what is he saying, how the Pope says is actually affects the global order, because he is a global leader, and he's a polarizing figure, I guess, as every major leader is. But for that to, I mean, I think we need to be able to see through that, and you know, not just stay with what I've heard once that I didn't like, or what I heard once that I really loved, and just set everything aside. We need to be able to reach out to others, and that, at the end of the day, is his biggest message. We need to build bridges and not walls.
Absolutely. Well, Inez, I always enjoy your work, and you're tireless in your approach, so I appreciate that, and you keep us informed. And always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
And I hope your show's going well with John as well.
It is. It's currently not as well as yours, but because, you know, we keep making up as we go.
Fake it till you make it. That's the way I look at it. That's been my approach.
Hey, we're working on it.
Inez, take care and blessings, okay?
Thank you very much, Mike. Have a good day.
We'll be back in a minute with more. This is the Mike Allen Show on Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show. Always enjoy talking with Inez San Martin of Crux. John Allen, the longtime Catholic journalist, probably the most reputed English-speaking Catholic journalist in the world, honestly. He's been tooting Inez's horn for some time, and she certainly has really grown as a writer and as a journalist, and really enjoy reading her stuff. And, you know, maybe next time I have her on, I'll ask her the question of whether she thinks even the clergy, even as high up as archbishops, cardinals, and so forth, whether they've fallen prey to the dichotomy, whether you're Francis lover or Francis hater. I think that'd be an interesting question, because certainly they get drawn in the popular conversations, you know, that you get the idea, you know, you got a Cardinal Burke over here who's in the Francis opposition, and you've got a Cardinal Supich out of Chicago. He's in the loyal to Francis camp, and they become almost sort of, you know, imagined pawns or characters in this whole chess game. And hopefully that they're able to sort of rise above that. But I've seen a little bit of it, I have to say, even among clergy. And, you know, she keeps talking about it. And one of the things, and I've talked about this with John Allen before, you know, when then Cardinal Ratzinger became Pope Benedict XVI, there was already a narrative attached to him as, you know, the German shepherd, the doctrinal enforcer, God's Rottweiler, all the rest, the Panzer Cardinal, and so forth. And so when he became Pope, that narrative was carried with him. And even though here was this very humble spirit or soul, he was very much portrayed as the rigid dogmatician, which anybody who knew him or actually read his stuff knew that was a false caricature. Well, the thing is with Francis is he really, if you'll recall, back in the day, almost 4 years ago, that he was elected to the papacy after all the handicapping and speculating about who was papabile, who was pope-worthy and all that. They announced his name, Bergoglio, and only the most inside baseball Vatican watchers knew who he was. The rest of us, particularly here in America, we were like, who? And then he walks out, looking as stunned as we were on the balcony, raises up the single hand, and we're trying to figure out who is this guy, Jorge Bergoglio, a.k.a. Pope Francis. And wow, it didn't take long before he began to have an impact, particularly through the use of gestures. But what happened is he got then a narrative attached to him. And that narrative, as oftentimes happens in journalism, the things that fit with the narrative get magnified. The things that contradict the narrative get downplayed. And so once that narrative has been scripted, then all what we do is simply feed into it. And that increases, I think, this sense of partisanship of Pope. So anyway, great conversation with Inez. You ought to follow her work. If you're not, just go to cruxnow.com and check it out. My question of the day is about U.S. President C-SPAN. Here yesterday, President's Day, C-SPAN coming out with a poll. They do this, I guess, after every change, every transition in presidencies. And it was a ranking of they polled 91 presidential historians on a whole host of different factors, from public persuasion to moral authority to crisis leadership and so forth. And they polled them, and they came up with overall rankings. And Barack Obama came out number 12 on the list, Lincoln, Washington, and FDR at the top. Obama down there at 12th, three ahead of Bill Clinton, whom I'm assuming moral authority tanked him pretty well. Anyway, my question is that ranking too low or too high? Some comments we've gotten from emails. Let's see. Bonnie says way too high. And Mary Lou concurs, says definitely too high. As his legacy unravels, his ranking is likely to drop.
producer Alex here says too high. But here's what my friend Todd said, which I thought was interesting. He said, so FDR invented the American welfare state, led his country into the biggest war in history, and put 100,000 Americans into internment camps because of their race. And he's number three. Trump will have to do a lot more than a 90-day pause on immigration from seven countries if he's going to move up this list. Yeah, you know, it's point taken. we might quibble over the American welfare state. I mean, everything's context. And, you know, FDR certainly came into a situation of a dire economic landscape, dire. I mean, people starving type of economic landscape. So I'm willing to cut him a little slack on that. Led his country into the biggest war in history. Again, context. You know, not exactly a preemptive war, but I do agree that the internment camps, 100,000 Americans into internment camps, way too little impact on this ranking list. You know, I was doing just a little bit of reading on this. Over 100,000 Japanese Americans forced out of their homes and into these government camps. Unbelievable. One of the low points, I would say, certainly in the last 100 years of American history. So maybe that should have more impact than to have FDR number three. Certainly somebody consequential. I mean, when you look at FDR serving, being elected four times, and then having his successor serve out the majority of his fourth term, and then get elected again. Pretty amazing in terms of what he did for the Democratic Party. That's why I think and tend to agree that the President Obama's ranking is too high and should drop, primarily because of the state in which he left the Democratic Party, which it's mind-boggling when you think about all the talk leading up to the November election was about the demise and the decline of the Republican Party. I mean, go back and check. I mean, it was considered pretty much a done deal that Hillary Clinton was going to be elected president. The House would probably go Democratic, and the Senate would probably go Democratic, and the House could go Democratic. And here we are now with Republican president, Republican House, Republican Senate. And the question is about the future of the Democratic Party, which I do think is a pretty tough stain, I think, on Barack Obama's legacy. I did get a interesting text here. I mean, Twitter said anybody who hates the Holy Father, any Holy Father, is not Catholic, period. This is from Edward J. Garcia. I would agree with you, Edward. Certainly there's no room for hating the Holy Father. And you know what bothers me sometimes? I've had issues, yes. There are things about Pope Francis's leadership style that, from my limited perspective as a Catholic now 12 years in, there have been things he's done or said at times that have bothered me. I always have to parse through and make sure I'm getting what he actually said and not the media spin on it. But even so, even though there have been times that I've gotten through the media spin and I've read it and I thought, gosh, he's a Jesuit. That's kind of my response, you know. Jesuits get a little squishy sometimes around things. And, you know, there have been times that I've been frustrated. But I love the Holy Father and appreciate so much the power at times of his gestures, even his words. I mean, this fourth chapter in Amoris Laetitia is pure pastoral gold, his reflections on 1 Corinthians 13. There's so much about, and I'll always love the Pope and always with great affection in prayer. So, yes, to hate the Holy Father is a betrayal of really what it means to be a Catholic. He's a sign of unity in the church. Even the most, you know, even the popes back in the day, the Borgias and all that, a Catholic should always begin with an attitude of love. And if one has a lover's quarrel with the Bishop of Rome over something, always make sure it is a lover's quarrel. And what kills me is, I have to say, and, you know, my friend Mark Shea, who also has a show in this network, points this out from time to time in his usual take no prisoners approach. But Mark Shea says, you know, what's amazing to him are the Catholics who will defend to the hilt everything that Donald J. Trump says, and yet continually harp on and undermine and attack Pope Francis. That, to me, is one of the most ridiculous things, and makes me, it tells me that you are a Republican who happens to be Catholic, then you are a Catholic who happens to be a Republican. The sheer incongruity of that, of seeing Donald Trump as almost transferring the charism of infallibility from Rome to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, is staggering. Anyway, we'll be back with more if you want to chime in. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show.
Again, my question of the day, 91 historians through C-SPAN rated Barack Obama as the 12th best president out of the 44 who have come before Donald Trump. Do you think that ranking is too high or too low? 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to call or text. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post a thought on Facebook or on Twitter, Mike Allen Show, the handle. We're only about, what, 2.5 weeks away now from Selection Sunday, which, if you're a sports fan, it's a holy day of obligation, a solemnity, when the beautiful brackets are revealed. Usually I consider the Monday after the Selection Sunday, because that's when I usually pick up a newspaper like a USA Today and begin analyzing my bracket. Oh, it's nothing better. Anyway, so they're looking at who are, you know, the big lead has the projected seedings. Of course, a lot can change in the next 2.5 weeks. But Villanova, Kansas, and Gonzaga, three of the number one seeds. Where I'm going to quibble is North Carolina as the projected fourth number one seed. North Carolina, I'm trying to remember where they rank defensively. They've got 10 wins, I see here, versus projected top 50 teams, which is impressive enough. But North Carolina, of course, you know, there's a lot of talk that perhaps whoever emerges victorious out of the ACC, whether it be North Carolina, Louisville, or Duke, will be the number one seed, which I guess I can see that. But, you know, if you're Oregon, you may have a quibble there. My Kentucky Wildcats down as the last number three seed projected out. That's assuming Kentucky loses one more game. I still think a three is probably the ceiling for Kentucky. Perhaps they could sneak into the bottom two. Virginia they have coming in as a number four. I tell you what they have. Here's a little surprising to me. UCLA coming in as a number four seed. Let me tell you something. If I were a number one seed, I would not want to see Lonzo Ball and UCLA sitting out there as a potential matchup in the Sweet 16. Just saying. Anyway, first reading for the Mass today, taken from the book of Sirach. Yesterday we were in Sirach. Today again in Sirach. Some common wisdom. Let's say this is one of the books that I wouldn't have been familiar with as a Protestant Christian. My son, when you come to serve the Lord, stand in justice and fear. Prepare yourself for trials. This is one of many warnings in Scripture, both Old and New Testament, that trials are to be expected. This is why I will say, when you hear someone go through some difficulty, some sickness or the loss of a loved one or some natural disaster, and the immediate reaction is, why God? Where are you? Why is this happening to me? I'm really not trying to be non-empathetic. Is that even a word? I understand that oftentimes when we go through pain, the pain talks and not our reason. But anyone who wonders or thought somehow they were going to be immune from suffering because they were a believer, because they were a good person, I don't know what Bible they're reading. Because it says it time and time again. I'm reminded of that passage in, I think it's the first letter of Peter, chapter 4, from the New Testament. Beloved, do not be surprised that a trial by fire is occurring among you, as if something strange were happening to you. I read a book a number of years ago. I don't agree with this theologian on several issues. His name is Gregory Boyd, but he had a book called God at War. But one of his premises in the book was the idea that, you know, this whole phenomenon of constantly questioning God when we go through suffering is largely a Western thing, that for the vast majority of people in the world and throughout history, they expected evil and sought to overcome it. We, on the other hand, act surprised by evil, and therefore we seek to understand it. Trials are par for the course. This is, you know, part of, it was interesting, that conversation I had yesterday with Chris Andrade, the guy who walked away from 20 years as a Wall Street trader to be a photojournalist, first among homeless drug addicts in the Bronx, and then going around middle America. He had a pulse and an understanding of Trump voters, let's just say, like that the rest of the media missed. People who have been sort of ground down by life and difficulties and so forth. But these are the very types of people, he said, who've taught him the most about faith. He, as a 16-year-old atheist with his swag on, you know, who thought he knew more than he did. And he assumed when he began to meet these suffering souls, people who'd been through so much and faced their own demons and injustice, that certainly he would find a common attitude and spirit of questioning meaning and questioning whether there was a God and so forth. And it was just the opposite. He found in their brokenness a depth of faith, even in the midst of the train wreck of their lives, that challenged his very simplistic atheism and made him realize that atheism is sort of an expression of first world privilege. You know, you can talk about things like these Neil deGrasse Tyson and others have about wanting to make a difference in the world and waking up, not thinking about eternal life, but how I can make a difference in the here and now and so forth and so on. It's easier said by people with means, people who suffer greatly, people whose lives are short and filled with bitter disappointment, who know nothing else but poverty. You're going to talk to them about wake up in the morning and make a difference in the world? Or rather, is it this yearning within them that makes them remarkably open to the kingdom of God? Because in their poverty of spirit, in their brokenness, they recognize that the world is not as it should be, and there has to be some hope beyond itself, or else life is not worth living. It's despair. And you may say, well, that's just wishful thinking. Well, is it also not wishful thinking for the first world privileged person to believe that ultimately he or she will not be held accountable for any decision they make in life? You could call that wishful thinking too. Anyway, what does this go on to say in Sirach? It talks about, it compares trials. It says, accept whatever befalls you, when sorrowful be steadfast, and in crushing misfortune be patient. For in fire, gold and silver are tested, and worthy people in the crucible of humiliation. Trust God and God will help you. Trust him. He will direct your way. Keep his fear and grow old therein. This whole idea of trials as a crucible. What is the purpose of a crucible? The purpose of a crucible is to surface the dross, the impurities that rise to the surface so that they can then be skimmed off. The crucible. To understand a trial. Wow, can you imagine if you believed that the trial had no point, that life was just simply a chemical reaction by chance, and that ultimately that the injustices or even our own, the fruit of our own misbehavior and poor decisions, it was just all meaningless. But the beauty of faith is this understanding that even in the midst of the trial doesn't eliminate the possibility of God. It is a sign that God is allowing it. Doesn't make the trial itself good, but that God is allowing it as a crucible, as a process by which he is bringing us to understand what true joy and happiness is. Anyway, maybe we'll get into this a little bit more tomorrow. I want to spin up the Dollar Catechism wheel because we're about out of time. We'll go to random.org, our random number generator. Spin up a number between 1 and 2865. Total number of paragraphs in the Catechism, 2745. Let's see, 2745. Here we go. All right, this is prayer and the Christian life. Prayer and Christian life are inseparable, for they concern the same love and the same renunciation proceeding from love, the same filial and loving conformity with the Father's plan of love, the same transforming union in the Holy Spirit who conforms us more and more to Christ Jesus, the same love for all men, the love with which Jesus has loved us. Whatever you ask the Father in my name, he will give it to you. This I command you, to love one another. This is a quote from, let's see, Origen, actually. He prays without ceasing, who unites prayer to works and good works to prayer. Only in this way can we consider as realizable the principle of praying without ceasing. Our life is a prayer. Now, this is not to excuse the lack of our own quiet contemplation. Prayer is a confession that I'm powerless to be who I need to be, who God wants me to be, and to do what God wants me to do apart from his strength. It's a great book I read a number of years ago. It was Too Busy Not to Pray. Good words indeed. We'll be back tomorrow. If you're in your crucible, God's doing something. Don't miss it. We'll be back tomorrow. This is the Mike Allen Show.
Listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.